Radio Prague News. Czech rescue workers are ready to leave for earthquake-stricken regions in Asia. There have been no reports of injured Czech nationals in the region, and British investigators believe that the IRA's chief of staff could be laundering his money in the Czech Republic. Czech rescue workers are ready to leave for earthquake-stricken regions in Asia as soon as the local authorities specify their needs. Czech firefighters as well as special rescue teams are ready to leave within 24 hours, spokesperson said. A number of Czech charities have said they are going to open special accounts for public donations towards the renewal of the damaged areas. According to Czech embassies in the afflicted countries, there are no reports of Czech casualties. The Defense Ministry has said that the Czech military contingent in Afghanistan has not been affected. The Czech humanitarian workers in the country are also reported to be safe. According to Saturday's edition of The Times, British financial investigators believe that the property empire built up by the IRA's chief of staff, Thomas Murphy, extends from Britain and Ireland into the economies of Eastern Europe, including the Czech Republic. Mr. Murphy, who has amassed a personal fortune estimated at £40 million, mainly from cross-border smuggling, is alleged to have begun laundering his money by investing in property and legitimate businesses in Bulgaria, Spain, Slovenia and also the Czech Republic. Prime Minister Jiří Paroubek has said he would like to make use of the good name and image of the former Czechoslovakia in the Czech Republic's foreign policy. Mr. Paroubek said many people abroad still refer to the Czech Republic as Czechoslovakia even 12 years after the country ceased to exist. He also said that both the Czech Republic and Slovakia could benefit from the use of the trademark. According to the Prime Minister, the name Czechoslovakia could be used in the same way as the Made in the USSR mark sometimes appears on the products of certain Baltic states. A special jury has selected five designs out of over 400 entries in a competition intended to find a new logo for the Czech Republic. The jury will make the final selection from the shortlist in late November or early December. The new logo is not meant to replace the Czech Republic's state symbols, but to represent the country at trade fairs, exhibitions and media presentations as a modern EU member state with world competitive services, a rich past and interesting present. And finally, a glance at the weather. We can expect partly cloudy skies and daytime temperatures between 16 and 19 degrees Celsius. I'm Pavla Horáková, that's the news.
You're listening to Radio Prague. I'm Rob Cameron. Coming up in a few minutes, the regular language course on Radio Prague, the ABC of Czech. That's with Pavla Horáková, followed by this week's one-on-one, another chance to hear this interview between Jan Wellinger and best-selling Irish author John Connolly. But we start with all the weird and wacky stories to appear in the Czech Republic this week. It's Magazine with Daniela Lazarová.
Some Czech towns are having a serious problem with rodents. In Prague, the Ahold store, which was recently closed down because it was infested with mice, is a good example. The store claimed it applied pest control measures several times a week without result. Radek Martinec from the town of Zlín has his own story to tell. When he sliced a loaf of bread for breakfast a few days ago, he was amazed to find what he believes to be a mouse baked inside it. The gruesome object is now being inspected by the hygiene office to ascertain what that particular loaf was flavoured with. But whatever it was, Martinec says, he's buying rolls for breakfast in future. Although the respective bakery has apologized profusely and claimed that nothing similar has ever occurred in the past, food inspectors are keeping a very close eye on the store. Meanwhile, a Prague judge found that mice do not only settle where there is food to be had. He came to work one morning to find several court files and papers on his desk covered with funny ink marks. A couple of rodents at first dipped their feet into an open ink tray for rubber stamping and then proceeded to do a dance all over the papers on his desk. If he had any doubt at all as to who the culprit was, they were soon dispelled. A huge rat with bright dark blue feet feet stood watching him from a corner of the room. A planned park, which is to be called the Garden of Eden, is expected to become the romantic setting for many Czech weddings in the future. The project in Prague's third district is expected to cost 20 million crowns, and the future Garden of Eden will boast a lake and gazebo. The park should be finished and open to the public sometime in 2007, and hopefully it will be home to many marriages made in heaven. Czechs excel at do-it-yourself jobs around the house and garden. A chronic lack of all kinds of goods during the communist years and the need to save money taught them to be smart and inventive when it came to furnishing their homes or country cottages. For years, Czech television has featured a weekly program based on homemade ingenious devices for the house and garden. And now, Czech television viewers will get a peek at the competition. A Hungarian TV station, TV Deco, will soon be available on satellite, and it is entirely devoted to do-it-yourself topics. The station will be available to viewers in the Czech Republic, Hungary and Slovakia as of December 1st, and to Romanian viewers early next year. No doubt Czech DIY fans will welcome getting inspiration from abroad. Already many of them are cooking with TV Paprika. The village of Botetice in southern Moravia has won the title Village of the Year. The winner of this annual competition gets a 1 million crown grant from the Regional Development Ministry with no strings attached as to how it should be used. Botetice beat 13 rivals who got into the final round out of 263 overall contestants, getting the award for best maintenance, sport and play facilities for children, a busy social life and a well-maintained vineyard. Animal rights activists have protested against the way that animals are portrayed in ads, claiming that many ads involving animals are misleading and unethical, and that they adversely influence the way people feel about certain breeds. For instance, an advertisement on a certain brand of vodka portrays wolves as dangerous predators who attack human beings. Animal rights activists say they do not know of any case in which a healthy specimen of this breed had attacked a human. Similarly, an ad showing a beaver destroying a wooden hut on the water has angered animal lovers who point out that beavers do not eat dead wood, but only living trees. The firm which commissioned the latter ad says that exaggeration is perfectly acceptable in the world of advertising. Animal rights activists maintain that at a time when so many animal breeds are dependent on man's goodwill for survival, it is dangerous to give them a bad name. The condor named Charles, whom I told you escaped from a bird station 3 weeks ago, has just been found. After issuing appeals to the public, ornithologists got dozens of calls a day from people who had sighted the enormous bird, and eventually they managed to track him down in a field just 5 kilometers from his home. Although there were fears that Charles, who was born in captivity, would not be able to survive on his own in the wild, he appears to have done exceedingly well and enjoyed his 3 weeks of freedom to the full. Ornithologist Petr Kolmazník says the condor had obviously not suffered from a lack of food, because in the 3 weeks he had actually gained weight and had suffered no ill effects health-wise. Having tasted freedom, Charles is having a hard time getting used to his life in captivity once again, but ornithologists are extremely relieved to have got him back. If a poacher had sighted him first, Charles could have come to a very bad end. A group of young people from Moravská Třebová decided to make their own Škoda limousine, a car big enough to accommodate them all. They welded 3 Škoda cars together to produce the luxury vehicle and fitted it with a computer, a bar and a CD player. Their Škoda Limo has not passed the respective technical tests, so it's not actually allowed on the road, but it does get an airing around town and has become something of a local mascot. Its owners are very proud of it and boasts that it can run at a maximum speed of 100 kilometers per hour. A truly bizarre accident happened on the historic Vltava Rally race track this week. A tractor driver broke regulations and drove onto the one-way track, allegedly because he wanted to take a shortcut home. Within minutes, an oncoming Škoda car made a sharp turn and promptly crashed into the tractor at high speed. The racing car was demolished and the driver was injured, but the tractor merely backed off and drove away. "I couldn't believe my eyes," the racing driver said later. "You come to expect certain dangers on the track, but the idea that a tractor would suddenly materialize on the racetrack right in front of me would never have occurred to me in my wildest dreams. I still can't believe what happened." Well, the police are now investigating the incident. As for the tractor driver, he disappeared after realizing how much of a risk he'd taken.
Daniela with this week's edition of Magazine. It's time now for our regular language course here on Radio Prague, the ABC of Czech.
Welcome to the ABC of Czech, in which this season we look at words and expressions to do with Czech food and cuisine. Today's lesson's going to be a bit unusual, because for a different perspective, I asked 3 of my foreign-born colleagues to tell us about their favourite Czech dishes or strongest culinary experiences in this country. I first put that question to Radio Prague's Rob Cameron.
I don't actually eat much Czech food because I want to live beyond 40. But say my favourite dish, or perhaps the dish which is most unusual for us foreigners here, is the so-called smažák, or a smažený sýr, which, as you well know, translates as fried cheese. And it was the very, very first Czech dish I had, and I had it within about half an hour of arrival at Florence bus station in August 1992 at a little restaurant called Deminka, which is now a very posh Italian restaurant, but wasn't then. And I was presented with a plate of something square and deep fried in breadcrumbs, served with chips or French fries for our American listeners, and a big dollop of tartar sauce. And it was possibly one of the most amazing culinary experiences I've ever had in my life.
Radio Prague's Jan Wellinger was born in Canada, but as his parents are Czech, Jan was well familiar with Czech cuisine when he first arrived in this country.
My mom made Czech food quite on a regular basis, or quite often. And one of my favorites, one of those things that we didn't have too often was bramborák, the Czech potato pancake. That was kind of a treat when we could have that. But we didn't have it too often because of all the work that it took to actually kind of grind all the potatoes down in the blender. But to this day, I love bramborák, and when you put the garlic in and the smell of it on the frying pan. But unfortunately, it's something that I'm absolutely forbidden by my doctor to eat, so I don't eat bramborák anymore. But when I actually first came to the Czech Republic in 93, back then I still ate it, and I used to buy bramborák in some of the most horrible places, like Smíchovské nádraží, which is the train station in Smíchov, out of this little window coming out of the side from God knows where, under God knows what kind of hygienic conditions, so would never eat anything like that again.
And finally, I spoke to Brian Kennedy, who's originally from the United States.
I have to say that the worst meal I ever had was in neighboring Slovakia, and that was pasta with grunko, grunko being something like Nestle Quick sprinkled on top. So by comparison, I think the Czechs are doing it all right. But I remember in 1995 when I first came, and probably every third meal was smažený sýr, fried cheese with tartar sauce, French fries on the side, you know, very good for the heart, makes it work harder. Sounds disgusting, tastes great, but I remember being very depressed with the onset of winter and the disappearance of all vegetables from the shelves and the groceries, and it seemed everywhere were green tablecloths issued for free by the Star Parman Brewery, and brown food, pork chops or some other kind of meat, potatoes, sauerkraut, green tablecloths, brown food. It was only later when I learned the truism, Czechs only cook for themselves, and discovered that, yes, Czechs do know how to cook at home, not in the restaurants.
Many thanks to Brian Kennedy, Jan Wellinger and Rob Cameron for sharing their culinary experiences with us. Till next time, dobrou chuť or bon appétit.
And bon appétit to any of you who might be eating while listening to this program. And now it's time for One-on-One, another chance to hear this week's programme when Jan Wellinger talked to the best-selling Irish author John Connolly.
Next, fans of crime fiction should come into their own in One-on-One. My guest today is Irish thriller writer John Connolly. John Connolly is the best-selling author of a collection of macabre short stories and the Charlie Parker novels that have successfully blended mystery with the supernatural. Over five books, beginning with Every Dead Thing, Connolly's main character, Private Eye Charlie Parker, has found himself in some pretty sticky situations. In Connolly's latest, The Black Angel, the character even visits the Czech Republic to learn more about the origins of a famous Bone Chapel. The author himself has spent a great amount of time in this country, and he's come back many times over the years. When we met, the first thing I asked John Connolly about was how he felt about Prague.
This is probably one of the few cities in Europe, apart from Dublin, that I could see myself living in, since we're here talking in Prague. I came here when I was much younger. I came here at the beginning of the 1990s, and it was quite different than it is now. But I thought it was beautiful, and I was fascinated by its history. And history has played a big part in the Parker books. They're very much concerned about the past and the impact of the past upon the present. And a few years ago, I was reading a newspaper article, one of those Sunday supplement magazines, the colour magazines, and there was a feature on Sedlec, which is the ossuary beside Cut na Hora. And I just thought that the pictures were fascinating, these remains of about 40,000 human beings, I think, and furnished literally in that they've been made into chandeliers and monstrances, and they've been decorated in chains on the ceiling of the chapel. Dating, I think the beginnings were probably about the 16th century. There are four freestanding bone pyramids, and then later additions made in the 18th and 19th centuries. And I thought it was fascinating, and that had stuck with me. And when I began writing The Black Angel, I wanted a kind of symbol or metaphor that would run through the books, and Sedlec became it, reminding people that no matter how bad or good this life will be, it will pass. It will come to an end.
Within the genre, are there limits, and are there ways of bending restraints?
The big no-no is mixing elements of the supernatural with crime fiction. And I think it dates back to the very beginning when you go to, say, the Sherlock Holmes novels, and that idea that everything has a rational explanation. There was a guy called Father Knox who assembled what were called the rules of crime fiction. If you abided by Father Knox's rules, everybody would still be writing Agatha Christie novels. It would never have advanced. But one of his things was that, you know, no supernatural agency can be involved in the commission of a crime. In other words, you can't say the ghost did it. And people have tended to interpret that in a very, very narrow way. And they still dislike any hint of the supernatural or any hint of strangeness in the books. At the same time, they will allow things like cat mysteries. Now, I don't know whether you've ever read a cat mystery, and you look like a sensible man, so I doubt that you would have. Cat mysteries are mysteries in which, as you might have guessed, a cat solves the crime. And it's not just a cat that kind of trips up a burglar when the burglar's on the way out of the house. You know, the cat's going to get a glass of milk and then the burglar's down on the ground. These are cats that think and care about human beings. Now, I have so many problems with this on so many levels, but my particular one is that of all the animals that are going to give a rat's ass if something happens to you, a cat is way down on that list. It's like one step above an alligator, but without an alligator's emotional honesty, you know? But on the other hand, you know, cat mysteries are fine. Any hint of the supernatural is not fine. And that always annoyed me. I've always been fascinated by fairy tales and folk tales, particularly that darker European tradition. And if you read the Brothers Grimm, and if you read the introduction to their second collection, they said something very interesting. They said that every society and every age produces its own versions of the same tales and does it for the same reasons. In a way, we do it to deal with the darkness of the world. It's a way of putting patterns on it, of interpreting it. And I thought that you can possibly see that then break off into two strands. One strand goes off into the kind of ghost stories of M.R. James, these kind of creepy ideas that if you go off the beaten track, if you deviate from the path, you'll find that life is infinitely stranger than you thought it was. And another thread seems to go into darker crime fiction, because there doesn't seem to be a whole lot of difference between something, say, The Silence of the Lambs and some of those older stories. You can see the conventions of fairy tales being used by Harris. Cannibalism. Obviously, you know, the great fear in folk tales and fairy tales is of being eaten and of being consumed. Lectures like The Troll Under the Bridge. So there aren't those huge differences. And I thought it would be interesting to try some of them in.
What elements of the supernatural do you really find attractive?
I get asked a lot whether I'm a believer in ghosts, and I'm not. I'm a real skeptic. What interested me was, A, that literary tradition, but also the kind of religious element that inevitably comes with it. The Americans call crime fiction mystery fiction, and I think that's really interesting because it allows a kind of broader scope than just calling it crime fiction. But one of the definitions of mystery, if you go back to a dictionary and you look it up, is that it's a revelation from the mind of God that can't be understood by human reasoning alone. And that's how the Greeks would have understood it. That's how the writers of medieval mystery plays would have understood it. Something that is simply beyond human understanding. Mm-hmm. And it's that aspect that appeals to me.
Let's turn to your main character, Charlie Parker. He's a former homicide cop. He suffers a terrible personal tragedy in the first book. And that in many ways has defined who he is throughout the series. How much does Charlie Parker fit in within noir writing traditions, being the anti-hero who walks kind of the fine line at the edge of the law?
He is obviously very much part of that. I was very influenced by a writer, Ross MacDonald, who created a character called Lou Archer. And Archer at one point says, "I hear voices crying in the night and I go see what's the matter." And I love that idea of a human being who could not actually stand aside and let other human beings suffer. There was an Irish writer, an Anglo-Irish writer called Edmund Burke, and he said something quite interesting. He said that all that it takes for evil to triumph is for good men to stand by and do nothing. And I think at its heart, the kind of crime fiction that I like and that I write is about the importance of not standing by. And you don't engage in it because of money. You know, if you read Chandler, if you read Hammett, if you read Ross MacDonald, you'll find that the detectives in these novels, they don't take on cases because it's going to make them any money. They don't take on cases even because they're going to make their lives any better. You know, they know that their lives are going to become measurably worse, probably going to get beaten up. They know that they're going to ask questions nobody else wants to ask, but they can't not do it.
We've said in the past that Charlie Parker, in terms of being a first-person narrator, doesn't have to be reliable. And I wanted to ask you specifically for an example where we couldn't fully trust his take on events.
It really comes to the fore an awful lot in The Black Jewel. He's offered, at one point, an interpretation of his life. It is suggested to him that he may be X. This may be part of his nature. And he takes this and runs with it, essentially, and concludes a lot of things because of it. Particularly in the supernatural elements of the books, they tend not to be seen by other people. They tend to be things that Parker tells us about. He says, "Look, this is how I saw this thing." But nobody else sees it. It's purely his interpretation, and it's offered up to the reader. And it's clear that throughout the books that there is another interpretation for everything that he sees. So the reader is being left kind of to take what he says either as gospel truth, or to take some of it, or to dismiss it entirely.
Let me turn to another aspect of the Black Angel. It's perhaps a minor detail, but when you have street names and place names, it led me to ask this question. What parts of Prague are you most familiar with?
The first time I stayed here, God help me, I was really poor. I was a student, and I stayed in those awful student apartments up behind Stadium Strahov. No offence, but it had the most depressing bar I've ever been in. It was like drinking in Hitler's bunker, but it was the one nearest the apartments, I think. And that was my first taste of the city, really. And then I would come down Petrin Hill on the funicular and kind of got to know that area of the city. And this must be my 9th or 10th time back here.
Right,
and I've done, the great thing is that now I feel that I've done all the historical stuff. I never need to see the castle again. It's lovely. I never need to do that tour again. And so now I just get the pleasure of walking around it. And it's a wonderful city to walk around. And every time I come here, I find something a little bit different or something new to do.
Irish author John Connolly in conversation there with Jan Wellinger for this week's One-on-One. And that's all we have time for at Radio Prague, I'm afraid. Do send us your comments about that programme and anything else you hear on Radio Prague. Our address is Radio Prague 12099 Prague 2, or send us an email, english@radio.cz. But from me, Rob Cameron, and everyone here, take care and do tune in again soon.
Ici Radio Prague, programme en langue française des émissions internationales de la radio tchèque, onde courte. Pour bénéficier d'une agréable réception, voici la grille de nos horaires en temps universel et fréquence en kilohertz. Europe. 5930, 7345. 7h30, 7h57, Europe. 9880, 11600. 16h30, 16h57, Europe, Afrique Centre. 5930, 17485. 18h30, 18h57. Europe, Afrique Ouest, 5930, 13580. 22h, 22h27, Amérique du Nord, 9415, 7345. Nous vous invitons à l'écoute sur le web. Pour cela, veuillez vous connecter au site www.radio.cz/français. Radio Prague est aussi sur le satellite. Vous trouverez toutes les informations sur notre site www.radio.cz/français.